very natural to happen in the West because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability. The UK Prime Minister fought as hard as he could, but he finally gave in. Boris Johnson has resigned as the Conservative Party leader. This will pave the way for a successor to replace him as the British Prime Minister, after over 50 of his ministers quit the government. He will, however, continue as Prime Minister until autumn. A Tory leadership race will take place this summer, and the winner will replace Johnson by October. Boris Johnson's premiership plunged into crisis following the dramatic resignations of Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the Health Secretary Sajid Javid. Javid, who served as the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, made reference to Johnson's failed leadership as the reason for quitting his post.
And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough. Yeah. I believe that point is now.
Further resignations have followed with the education ministers Will Quince and Robin Walker and ministerial aide Laura Trott quitting.
He had scandal after scandal, miscalculation after miscalculation. He's lost the confidence of, I assume, the country going by the recent by-election results. And more recently, he's lost the confidence of many senior members of his government, with over 40 of them now resigning.
Johnson was under mounting pressure after apologizing for appointing MP Christopher Pincher to a role involved in offering pastoral care to his party, even after being briefed that the politician had been the subject of complaints about sexual misconduct.
He knew the accused minister had previously committed predatory behavior, but he promoted him to a position of power anyway. Why?
They're looking at the future. They're looking at the next Conservative government being returned in 2024. I believe they feel that won't happen with Boris Johnson at the helm. Therefore, people are jockeying for position. The knives are out. It's a Caesar and Brutus type political ending of his career.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the scandals that surrounded him drowned his political life, and he found himself to have fallen out of favor with the general public in the UK. Prior to his resignation, a snap YouGov poll had found that 69% of Britons thought that Johnson should step down as Prime Minister. The timing of his resignation could not be any worse. The UK is experiencing a cost of living crisis like no other time in its history. Many Britons are struggling to cope with rising fuel and food prices. Economists say that the country is now heading for a sharp slowdown or possibly a recession.
He is, for his own political, selfish purposes, been running this country's economy into the ground, and worse, far worse, he has been threatening a peace process. That's all I've got to say.
And things will get much, much worse before the next general election. And I think regardless of who wins that election, we will continue to see an economic crisis.
Now with a new administration set to take the helm in September or in early October, the real concern for the UK is how it will cope with the economic crisis until then. This is not to dismiss the fact that there are no guarantees that the new administration will be able to deal with the economic onslaught that will be piled on it.
I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says the Federation will be a partner in the lawsuit filed against the Israeli occupation in the International Criminal Court. A member of the executive board of the Federation says the move came after the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate succeeded in persuading the Federation to file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. IFJ stated that the filing comes in light of the Israeli aggression against Palestinian journalists and people. Earlier, the Journalist Syndicate had said that it succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The circumstances of Shirin Abu Akleh's killing on May the 11th have been investigated by several international organizations. All concluded that it was a bullet fired from an Israeli rifle that killed the Al Jazeera correspondent and injured her fellow journalist as they covered an Israeli raid in Jenin. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probes, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. But the question is, will there and can there be accountability for the crimes committed by Israel?
And the absence of punishment shows hypocrisy, double standards, and deception and lies. So this is an opportunity for journalists to present all of the best documented evidence, research, discovery that they've done about crimes against humanity that the Israeli apartheid regime has committed. And the more international they go, the louder they go, the more they invite other countries to be participants, to join the lawsuit against Israel, the more you're building international consensus in support of the people who have been violated, dehumanized, killed, robbed, or in other way injured by this grotesque apartheid Israeli policy and agenda of genocide, bigotry, and destruction. So it's a very essential step, and I'm glad they're taking it.
Earlier this month, Palestinian officials handed over to U.S. forensic experts the bullet that killed Abu Akleh. But despite all the evidence pointing fingers towards Israel, the U.S. said it could not reach a definitive conclusion on the origin of the bullet. Meanwhile, Abu Akleh's family have expressed their anger over the U.S.'s disregard for what several courts and rights organizations have stated and its failure to accept that its ally has murdered a journalist in broad daylight. The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says that Israel was guilty of the crime and expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into Palestinian journalist Abu Akleh's killing. The U.S., on the other hand, has not condemned this act, yet aside from saying there needs to be an independent investigation, raising questions about whether the U.S. is seeking the truth or to protect its ally.
Well, absolutely, the U.S. is guilty of supporting the regime. The U.S. is guilty from enabling the regime to engage in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The U.S. has been guilty of stealing money from the American people and giving it to the Israeli apartheid regime and giving them weapons and, in fact, looking the other way when Israel had developed nuclear weapons, but that's another story. But Israel's crimes and abuses against the Palestinians, against the Syrians, against Lebanon, against all sorts of countries and nations and peoples, the U.S. is the partner in crime that is responsible. And if the U.S. does not hold a moral standard and a very clear objectivity and a dedication to truth and justice, then the U.S. is showing that it has no dedication to truth and justice, but instead has a dedication to lies and crime.
The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measures, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel. Yet no one, including the United Nations Security Council, has used any of its tools to ensure its resolutions. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has ruled that it has a mandate to investigate the occupied territories and has accepted the Palestinians after they were granted non-member observer status at the UN. This comes despite Palestinians' inability to join the ICC, as Israel is not a member and Palestinians do not qualify as a sovereign state. A new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, which requires the full or partial disclosure of previously unreleased information and documents controlled by the U.S. government upon request, offers the first official confirmation of Pentagon's use of the secretive 127E authority in multiple countries. 127E is one of the several virtually unknown authorities granted to the Defense Department by Congress over the last two decades that allows U.S. commandos to conduct operations on the fringes of war and with minimal outside oversight. And now, the report indicated that American troops conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world between 2017 and 2020. The document also shows that at least 14 127E programs were also active in West Asia and the Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. Separately, Joseph Votel, a retired four-star Army general who headed both Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in West Asia, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E so-called counter-terrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen.
The actual main purpose of U.S. Special Forces is to train and educate foreign fighters. And so they've done this in places that we would never, that the United States people would never support in Africa, Central America, and places like that. And in fact, we created the School of the Americas, which trained Central American people to how to torture people properly.
The 127E program, an obscure program that even U.S. lawmakers are not familiar with, one that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by, with, and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. But all this only seems to be another term for waging a proxy war in another country through the use of local forces. The origins of the 127E program can be traced back to the earliest days of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, as commandos and CIA personnel sought to support militants there. Army Special Operations Command soon realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new proxies and was forced to rely on CIA funding. This prompted a broader push by SOCOM to secure the ability to support foreign forces in so-called missions, a military corollary to the CIA's use of militia surrogates. First known as Section 1208, the authority was deployed in the early years of the Iraq invasion, according to a former senior defense official. It was ultimately enshrined in U.S. law under USC Title 10, Section 127E. But so far, the U.S. waging of proxy wars and its use of local forces to achieve its aims have been costly for countries targeted by Washington.
I would use the example of the Philippines, where Duterte, who was a very right-leaning president, kicked the United States Special Forces out, even though they were operating in his space. In support of what he was doing, he kicked them out because he just didn't want that element in his country. American foreign policy is insane in every way that it possibly can be.
Critics in the U.S. have also contended that, due to a lack of oversight, 127E programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders, on the other hand, claim it is crucial to combating terrorism. But so far, the U.S.'s proxy wars in most countries where this program has been implemented, including West Asian nations like Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Lebanon, have mostly been witnessing instability, which is more likely than not a direct result of the program and proxy elements and fighters.
Thank you. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, former Chancellor Rishi Sunak has thrown his hat into the ring in the race to succeed Boris Johnson. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Heather Stewart, Rainer Mason and Peter Walker. The piece is titled Rishi Sunak to Stand for Conservative Party Leader. Former Chancellor Rishi Sunak described himself as a serious candidate for serious times as he kick-started his campaign to become the UK's next Prime Minister, with as many as 15 Conservative MPs expected to run for the party's leadership. The former Chancellor launched his bid on Friday, 8th of July, after telling colleagues he had 80 to 100 MPs behind him. Some began declaring their support publicly, including Mark Harper, the former Chief Whip, Oliver Dowden, the former party co-chair, and Mark Spencer, the leader of the House of Commons. Rishi Sunak's announcement came in a slickly edited 3-minute video message posted on Twitter under the slogan, Ready for Rishi. I'm standing to be the next leader of the Conservative Party and your Prime Minister, he said. Let's restore trust, rebuild the economy, and reunite the country. His declaration capped an extraordinary week in Westminster in which Boris Johnson's authority dramatically collapsed, with more than 50 members of his government quitting before the Prime Minister finally announced his resignation on Thursday, 7th of July. Saying the country faced serious challenges, Rishi Sunak strongly indicated he would resist calls for widespread tax cuts or a spending spree. Do we confront this moment with honesty, seriousness and determination, or do we tell ourselves comforting fairy tales that might make us feel better in the moment, but will make our children worse off tomorrow, he said. Tax cuts are expected to feature heavily in what is likely to be a chaotic and at times bitter leadership race. Another declared candidate, the One Nation Tory, Tom Tugendhat, has already called for the recent national insurance increase to be reversed. The former Equalities Minister, Kemi Badenoch, announced her candidacy in The Times, also appeared to back lower taxes, saying she wanted a limited government focused on the essentials. His announcement came as allies of Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, said she was seriously considering running for the leadership of the Conservative Party, suggesting the politics of some of the other frontrunners were unclear. You don't need to think about Priti. You know where she stands, one said, comparing her to Margaret Thatcher. The Culture Secretary, Nadine Dorries, a diehard Boris Johnson loyalist, is also reportedly consulting colleagues about whether she has sufficient support to run. The Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, considered a potential frontrunner, could also declare his bid. Arch-Brexiter Steve Baker has announced that he would not run but would support a bid by the Attorney General, Suella Braverman, on Friday evening. He tweeted, I considered standing for the leadership. My priorities were delivering against our manifesto with our mandate, cutting taxes and seeing through Brexit. Happily, I no longer need to stand, Suella Braverman will deliver these priorities and more. Boris Johnson fired the starting gun on the race on Thursday, 7th of July, when he reluctantly quit as Conservative leader with a defiant speech describing his colleague's decision to oust him as eccentric and a result of herd instinct. One senior Tory with knowledge of Boris Johnson's mood described him as confused on Friday. Not focused in a dumb sense, he fully understands the process, but he is confused as to their plan and strategy because there isn't a clear way through. Johnson continued to fill the post in his caretaker government with loyalist Peter Bone, made deputy leader of the House of Commons, and his policy chief Andrew Griffith, a junior trade minister. Other cabinet ministers are expected to declare their candidacy in the coming days, including the new Chancellor, Nadeem Zahawi, the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, the Health Secretaries turned backbenchers, Sajid Javid and Jeremy Hunt. Nadeem Zahawi is believed to have the most organised campaign with a team in place, advised by Linton Crosby's former business partner, Mark Fulbrook. The executive of the Backbench 1922 Committee will be re-elected next Monday and is then expected to set out the rules and duration of the leadership race, including spending limits. While some MPs have been pressing for Boris Johnson to step down as soon as possible, others are keen to see a full-blown contest, perhaps lasting until September, to allow for the backgrounds of the candidates to be properly scrutinised. Boris Johnson's premiership unravelled after it emerged that he appointed Chris Pincher as deputy chief whip, despite knowing of his past alleged sexual misconduct. "I think all of the candidates have got significant due diligence vulnerabilities, things they're exposed on that will hit the media," said one senior Conservative MP, adding, "There's really going to be a big field. I think there could be as many as 15 candidates or even more." A former cabinet minister said the worst possible thing that could happen to the Tory party is that they appoint somebody in a hurry, and that person has another ethical problem, whether it's a money problem, a historic drugs problem, or other problems. If that happens, however good the policies are, we're in trouble at the next election. Party insiders are warning that the race, in which the field will be narrowed down to two MPs, ideally by the time Parliament rises on 21st of July, before Tory members get the final vote, is expected to be hard-fought. "I think it will be a very divisive contest, knowing the sort of people who are involved. I think there will be a lot of really nasty briefing," said one senior Tory. Speculation at Westminster has also already turned to whether a new leader would feel obliged to call a snap election, perhaps within 6 months, to give them a personal mandate. If they want to do anything big and new, it's a 75 majority on the old manifesto and a Boris Johnson platform, which is dead, said a party insider. "If you actually want to do stuff, radical things in a recession, then you have to put it to the country." The leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, has made clear he will push for a general election. At a press conference after the news that he would not be fined for an alleged breach of lockdown rules, Keir Starmer said, "If there's a general election, this government will fall and we've got a plan for the country." As a leadership race unfolds, there are likely to be perils and controversies ahead for Boris Johnson's caretaker role at No. 10 Downing Street. While it has been agreed he will not introduce new policies or major fiscal decisions, Johnson's spokesperson stressed that potentially contentious actions on existing plans, such as defending court cases to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda and pushing through the bill to unilaterally amend the Northern Ireland Protocol, would go ahead. Among other tricky moves looming is a decision on a series of public sector pay awards amid the threat of strikes. The government's verdict on these could come as early as next week, potentially with several awards announced simultaneously.
aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. We witness how, cloaked in the shadows from the light of public scrutiny, the Bilderberg Group began to form their own self-serving agendas and wielded their immense power and resources to redesign the world in their vision. Yet, today, this old institution faces a new climate thanks to a new wave of savvy investigative journalists who attempt to peel away the secret history and ongoing influence of this organization. Don't go away. Here's the next part.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has been deeply involved in the Bilderberg Group, attending dozens of their meetings over the years and acting on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. Kissinger faces allegations of war crimes for his involvement in the secret bombing campaign that took place in Cambodia during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. It is alleged that Kissinger willfully engaged in the murder of tens of thousands of civilians in various areas of Cambodia, which led to the destabilization of the country into a civil war, resulting in the rise of the infamous Khmer Rouge. Kissinger is also wanted in several countries for his involvement in supporting the Pinochet regime and the CIA-backed coup that took place in Chile on September 11, 1973. Pinochet, who is now facing a war crimes tribunal, murdered the democratically elected President Salvador Allende and started a military junta, which resulted in the kidnapping, forced displacement, and torture of thousands of men, women, and children in Chile. Henry Kissinger actively supported these actions that were taking place at that time, which constituted crimes against humanity. Kissinger was also involved in a controversial study in 1974 called National Security Study Memorandum 200, in which the basic thesis called for an active campaign for the depopulation of several less developed countries to stem the risk for civil unrest. The Bilderberg Group include many prominent members of the internet and computing world, including National Security Agency Director and Chief of the United States Cyber Command, General Keith B. Alexander, co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, founder of PayPal and Chief Facebook Investor, Peter Thiel, Executive Chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, Vice President, European Commission, Commissioner for Digital Agenda, Neelie Kroes, Chief Research and Strategy Officer, Microsoft Corporation, Craig J. Mundy, and many others. The increase of internet-based media has been closely correlated with the decrease of traditional forms of media, such as newspapers and television, which have been monopolized by members of the Bilderberg Group. In their efforts to maintain the control of information globally, influential figures of the media have been routinely invited to participate in the conferences over the years. Peter Mansbridge of CBC's The National attended the meeting in 2010 and has maintained their strict rules for secrecy ever since. Fellow Canadian Heather Reisman is the CEO of Indigo Books, the largest book supplier in Canada, and she is a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. In 2005, Reisman founded the Hesseg Foundation, which provides grants to former lone soldiers in the Israeli Army to pursue post-secondary education. A lone soldier is an individual who is not from Israel, but chooses to fight in the Israeli military. Other media moguls and organizations that have attended the Bilderberg meetings over the years have included Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation, Andrew Knight of News Corporation and The Economist, Ted Turner of Time Warner and CNN, Charlie Rose, Donald Graham of The Washington Post, and Canadian media baron and former Bilderberg Steering Committee member Conrad Black of Hollinger International and the Telegraph newspaper. While all of these powerful media organizations have been present at Bilderberg meetings over the years, there has remained a media blackout all across the board regarding coverage of this group.
Hi. I was just wondering what your opinions were. You talk a little bit about it in the book, of the influence of the Bilderberg group on the mainstream media, or on just the influence.
The individuals are influential, but their influence isn't magnified by Bilderberg. I went for 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a talking shop, and they're almost always wrong, by the way. They didn't see the end of the Cold War coming. They didn't see the economic crisis coming. They're very interesting meetings. They're very interesting people, but they're not coherent. They aren't a group that meets other than for 3 days a year, and the composition of them changes all the time, except for about 30 of us who are on the steering committee.
And how come?
Don't buy into these conspiracy theories. It's rubbish. All they do is talk to each other. I was on that conference circuit for 20 years, the Trilateral Commission, and I went to all of them. And it was fine while it lasted, but I'm getting too old for that. I'm getting tired.
Okay.
You know.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks.
Right.
But there's no conspiracy in any of them.
No.
No, there's just a bunch of people.
How come you don't ever hear about it in the media? Like, I only read about it in your book.
They don't allow the media.
No.
But in order to encourage people to talk frankly, which you do, you get good, frank sessions. But there's no meeting of the minds, particularly.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Fellow Hollinger International Board of Directors member Marie Jose Kravis has made significant inroads since being invited to Bilderberg by Conrad Black in 1989. Marie Jose is the wife of Bilderberg member Henry Kravis and has been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee for over 22 years. At the trial of the now defunct media baron Conrad Black, Marie Jose Kravis testified against him, providing evidence for the prosecution. Other prominent Canadians who have attended the Bilderberg conferences include former Prime Minister of Canada Lester B. Pearson, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper. Many other influential Canadian politicians and business leaders have also attended the secret meetings, including former NDP leader Bob Rae, former Liberal Party leaders Stéphane Dion and Michael Ignatieff, former Premier of Ontario Mike Harris, former Premier of New Brunswick Bernard Lord, former Premier of British Columbia Gordon Campbell, the Premier of Alberta Alison Redford, the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper Nigel S. Wright, and Power Corporation of Canada CEO Paul Desmarais Sr. In fact, nearly every Canadian Prime Minister back to Pierre Elliott Trudeau has worked for Power Corp.
In 1996, you were at a Bilderberg meeting, and also there was Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin.
I don't know if I was at that meeting. I've only been to a few of them, but Bilderberg and Trilateral are not really think tanks. They're simply individuals who get together who are from business, the political world, the media, others, and discuss ideas, and they influence each other through that.
Shortly after Dan and Steve got back from the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, I decided to file some Access to Information Act requests for information on both Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, and for Nigel S. Wright, who is the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I received two notices. One was for Nigel S. Wright, and it actually revealed very little. They just said that they didn't have any record of him having attended the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, even though he was on the official attendees list. In 2011, the Harper government decided to amend the Access to Information Act and privacy request forms, making it so that anybody that was on the Prime Minister's cabinet was exempt from releasing any personal information. In the case of Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, I did receive actually quite a big disclosure from their executive council office in Alberta. 31 pages were disclosed to me just the other day. All sorts of different pages have notices to destroy these emails, do not release this information to the public, do not release any information about your travel itinerary prior to attending the meeting. But a lot of the stuff is redacted. A lot of this information is redacted out. that's cited under different sections of the Privacy Protection Act, which is goes hand in hand with the Access to Information Act request. So any other information that was in there about other people has been redacted out. There's also a page in here that describes the nature of the meetings off the record. Fruitful discussions are enhanced by an atmosphere of mutual trust in which participants can express themselves freely. All discussions are therefore private and off the record. The press is excluded from the meetings. A list of participants will be released to the press on the eve of the conference. There's nothing to hide. If you're doing good things, you don't have anything to hide. There's only something to hide if you don't want people hearing what you're saying. That's the only reason to say it off the record, is that you wouldn't want to be quoted on something that could be damaging to your career.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
How do you feel about secrecy in government?
It's a scary thing. I mean, it's secret, so I don't really know much about it.
I can understand if the secrecy is for national security, but, you know, secrecy and covering up, you know, financial documents and things like that, I think as taxpayers, you know, we have the right to know what's going on in our government.
I think secrecy is pretty inherent in the Canadian government, for sure, and in all government. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish government was completely democratic, which would mean that we would be a part of it. But seeing as, like, we have representatives in this House deciding on issues for us, secrecy kind of just comes with that.
I honestly don't think it's a good idea for anybody to be secret. I don't think anything should be secret. I think if anything needs to be said, it needs to be said in front of the people here that can hear it.
We elect people to govern us in a democratic way. And when those people fall, you know, prey to, you know, individuals that have money or, you know, have leverage on them, it's no different than a dictatorship.
When you have, like, government officials and then you have financiers and, like, heads of, like, banks meeting behind closed doors, that's already against the law.
We have really no idea. And without you guys, we wouldn't be around to know, so.
The more independent media that covers events like this or like anything gives a more unbiased opinion, considering how slanted our current media is.
It doesn't have to be a, you know, massive media tycoon that's controlling what's being said anymore, you know? The average person can do it, right? Which is, I mean, you know, that's an amazing feat. We didn't have that 50 years ago. We didn't have that at all.
It's time to get it out there. We should at least know. We should at least know.
Almost everybody here has a camera. They're all doing live streaming. They're all, you know, interviewing people. I mean, there is just everywhere from, you know, really big names with big websites to just people doing their own little thing. And it's crazy. I mean, everybody has a camera this year.
We live in the time of intelligence, of technology, of instant information. And more these people are realizing that, and they're going to realize that today with the hundreds of people that are surrounding the Marriott Hotel where Bilderberg 2012 is being held.
What do you think about, you know, the independent media's these days ability to use social media and live streaming at these kinds of events?
It's amazing, and it shows you how many people that are getting aware and politically aware to this.
Isn't everyone's becoming the independent media because of the double-edged sword that is social media? It's also, of course, a spy tool, as everyone knows.
They're worried about us. They're worried about you. They're worried about every person out here with a cell phone that's able to broadcast live or put the video online, where in the decades past it would require an entire news crew, an assignment, tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Now we can do it standing out here with a cell phone. So their technology that they're using to bug us, their Orwellian nightmare, Big Brothers, or surveillance systems, we're just turning it against them and showing them that we're watching.
What we're seeing here in 2012 represents not just an evolution of social media, of independent media, of the ability of citizen journalists to bring attention to causes that and events that the mainstream media will refuse to cover.
You had thousands and thousands of people watching live stream video, you know, They're interested. People are dying for real information, truth.
We are able to pretty much broadcast to the world, to thousands of people, live, unedited, uncut, as everything's happening, pretty much just through a cell phone. It's, you know, we're living in amazing times. The technology is advancing.
It's like more than it's a protest, it's almost an independent media summit. You know, there are at least 20 cameras here live streaming, not all like with some central hub. No, 20 independent media outlets, 20 individuals doing separate live streams.
We are making a difference. We are forcing the mainstream media to cover these events, you know, and they are coming kicking and screaming, but they are coming.
If you had an opportunity to maybe say a short little message to the people in that room, the people sitting around that table, what might you say to them?
That's a hard question.
It's a tough one. I know. It's a tough one. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It is.
Second. But if I could say anything to the Bilderbergers is when you do things in darkness, they will come to the light. And they are. We're here just to shine that light. I don't hate you. I'm not going to spend my energy just to negatively go after you. But I will expose you, and I will talk to you, and I will communicate with you with words to try to make you and the world understand that there's a lot more going on than we actually know, and we deserve to know what's happening. We're human beings. We're just as equal as you, and we're all in this world together.
My message to the globalist is the sleeping giant that is humanity is awakening. It's 1776 against their 1984 worldwide. Their system of 1984 against the spirit of liberty. And they will be defeated. And they know it. And they're starting to run scared. And they should be. Because information is power. And the truth is setting us free.
We know who you are, and we're taking our fate back.
We know who you are, and we're going to expose you. All the way. So we're not stopping. We're going to be growing in numbers 100 times this in the future. So just wait. Just wait. We're coming.
I'm sure you guys realize, you know, that this is the fate of the planet. You guys are in control one way or another. People are finding out what's going on.
Life is short. We should live it to the fullest and treat people with respect, honesty, dignity, and compassion. And you could change your life in any moment, any time, and just think about the decisions you're making and how they affect people and how they hurt people, and understand there's real consequences for those decisions that you guys have made, that you guys will have to live with for an eternity, pretty much.
When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan said, if you bow down and worship me, I will give you the world. Well, guess what? You've got the world, and we're not going to bow down and worship you. Those filthy deeds that you have done in secret are now being shouted from the housetops. We are on to you.
The reach of the Bilderberg Group extends to every level of the policy apparatus in both the private and public sectors. Its members over the years have been the most influential and powerful individuals in the world. Whether or not they act in concert with each other or simply influence one another through these meetings is beside the point. The decisions made by each of these individuals have a ripple effect for the rest of the world. For every action, there is an equal but opposite reaction. The creation of this new Orwellian technotronic society has spawned a new generation of warrior, information warriors, whose weapons are the very technologies created to enslave them. As the old forms of media slowly die away, this generation is finding new and exciting ways to spread information, open dialogue, and become the true citizen media. The Bilderberg Group and the individuals that attend are now facing a revolutionary adversary, an informed citizenry armed with the right questions and looking for the true answers.
Well, and shining a much-needed light upon these unprecedented levels of secrecy and powerful world players, this new age of citizen media bravely contends that the Bilderberg Group's lobbying powers represent nothing less than a threat to the democratic process. Well, that's it, everyone, for this week. But join me here next time for another documentary. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
What is the philosophy of Eid al-Adha? Imam Khamenei explains. If we pay attention to the philosophy inherent in Eid al-Adha, many paths will be opened for us. A select messenger of the Righteous One, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, made a sacrifice on Eid al-Adha. In some cases, sacrificing your loved ones is beyond sacrificing your own life. Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was about to sacrifice a loved one in the way of God. A young child whom Allah the Exalted had bestowed on him at an old age after a lifetime of waiting. Praise be to Allah, who has given me in old age Ismail and Ishaq. Most surely my Lord is the hearer of prayer. The Holy Quran, Surah 14, verse 39. Allah the Exalted had bestowed these two sons on him at an old age, probably after a lifetime of impatient waiting. He had no hope of getting another child at that age. The chief of the martyrs of the entire world, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who is the symbol of sacrifice and martyrdom, remembers this event in the holy prayer of Arafah. He says, and Ibrahim decided to sacrifice his son at an old age after a lifetime of waiting. This is part of a supplication by Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Arafah, a supplication that was recited by Hajj pilgrims on Arafah Day. This sacrifice is a symbol for the faithful people who want to tread the path of truth, transcendence and perfection. This is impossible without a sacrifice. In fact, all the tests that we go through involve one essential element. All tests involve a sacrifice. Sometimes this involves sacrificing your life and wealth. Other times it involves forgiving somebody for a comment he makes and insists on stubbornly. Yet other times it involves sacrificing your dear ones, your children and your loved ones.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Being tested means going through hardships. When a hardship is placed in the way of an individual or a people, going through this hardship is a test. If they go through this hardship, they will reach the desired destination. And if they fail to utilize the talent within them, if they fail to overcome their passions, they will fall by the wayside. This is what a test is. God does not put us through divine tests in order to get to know us and see at what level we are. Divine tests are in fact a step towards one's destination. When we are tested and we manage to go through the hardships of tests, we enter a new situation, a new stage of life. A nation and an individual are not different from one another in this regard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The road to Lysychansk, the most recent city taken by the Russians. It's strewn with the debris of war and feels like a post-apocalyptic wasteland. It's a small settlement of Toshkivka. There's so much destruction, it's uninhabitable. One of a few villages we pass that may, quite literally, be wiped off the map.
Now, we're on the road to Lysychansk at the moment, but we've hit a problem. We've come to this part of the road where there's a bridge. The bridge is destroyed. So it looks like we're going to have to find another way around a detour.
The Ukrainians have blown up many such bridges in order to slow the Russian advance. We reach Lysychansk. Remarkably, much of it remains intact, as the Ukrainians gave up this city without much of a fight, although the central administration district saw the worst of the fighting.
And suddenly I see a car, from A to Z.
I went outside and saw a car driving with the letter Z on it. And there was a pro-Russian militia guy. He climbed up there, took off the Ukrainian flag, and hung the Russian flag, the flag of victory. And our joy began. People came to see the flag and they were happy. They were crying, laughing, and dancing. It was great, and I still feel this joy. I think it'll remain with me forever.
A statue commemorating the fallen Soviet soldiers during World War II. Ukrainians extinguished the eternal flame in an effort to expunge Russian culture from the city. It will be lit again soon. Now the city is under Russian control.
When it was Ukraine here, we lived, somehow. There were several incidents, like my wife owned a small hairdresser's. Once a man from some nationalist battalion came and made her speak Ukrainian. He was shouting and even kicked her. They took me away for questioning a few times. It was Ukrainization here. I'm Russian, and I was born here. They were trying to force us to assimilate.
They consider people here in Donbas subhuman. I always wondered whether we had horns or something. We were second-class citizens. One Ukrainian soldier who was born only 50 kilometers away from me asked me why I hadn't left to Russia. They told us all the time to leave. But why? I've lived here all my life. My parents died here. My daughter lives here. He told me I was pro-Russian and so I should leave. They treat us with hatred.
The Russian army has set up a museum on the street. Tanks and weapons taken from the retreating Ukrainian army. There are British N-Laws and American javelins, as well as an array of drones that have increasingly become an essential part of modern warfare.
We all have to work to restore our town. Those who can't work will work. Everybody. Old-age pensioners say they'll work anywhere if it's necessary. We will rebuild our town. It'll be great.
While this war is bringing devastation to the towns and cities in which the two armies meet, it also leaves behind a desire for peace and a determination for these people to rebuild their cities and their lives. Johnny Miller, Lisichansk.
Touting South Korea's nuclear technology to allies at a recent summit in Europe, President Yoon Suk-yeol will increase the country's nuclear energy production and boost reactor sales abroad. The previous administration began to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima nuclear disaster, problems with South Korea's aging reactors, and industry corruption. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's decision to reverse course and ramp up nuclear power comes as the country faces multiple challenges to meeting its energy requirements. South Korea imports almost 100% of its oil, leaving it open to costly crude price fluctuations. And rising temperatures have increased energy demand here to record levels. The government will resume suspended reactor construction, with nuclear generating 30% of the country's energy mix by 2030. The Yoon administration says the move will help the country reach carbon neutrality and create jobs. Environmentalists decry the policy turnabout.
Nuclear technology is inherently risky, and it's also expensive, and also it's not a good solution for climate change.
South Korea ranks last in the OECD in renewable energy production, such as solar, wind, and geothermal, which activists view as offering viable alternatives.
To replace fossil fuels without increasing nuclear and provide all the electricity needed with the renewables, that's a challenge. But based on the analysis from the government institutions, the renewable energy potential for South Korea is enough to provide all the electricity we need.
South Korea plans to export 10 nuclear reactors by 2030, currently vying for projects planned in Poland and the Czech Republic. Officials also this week announced funding for new small modular reactor, SMR, development. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After decades of fighting, victims and the families of those impacted by the Factor VIII blood contamination scandal could be headed for compensation of sorts. In one of the darkest periods for Britain's National Health Service, a shortage of clotting agents for haemophiliacs and others suffering from other blood disorders meant the country imported blood products from the US. It later emerged the blood had been distilled from a wide range of people, including prisoners, and had been poorly screened.